Arthur Shallach, of course, begins with and is dominated by the episode of the Miraglim. And there's no shortage of things to say and perspectives. And I would like actually to take a look at the beginnings of the Miraglim through the words of the Ramban. The danger, of course, when it comes to parshas like this is that we look back. It's hard for us to realize what could have gone wrong. We're quite sure that bastions of wisdom that we are, if we were there, we would have sorted the whole thing out. They would have done like this, and if only they'd listened to me, because we've learned Parshat Shelach, and they were Parshat Shelach. But that doesn't exempt us from trying to get a sense of what was involved. And the Ramban raises some major questions, basic questions, I would say, with regards to this episode. It's not light. Ramban is never light reading at all. I still remember many years ago, but someone was discussing with me an idea that she had for a bar mitzvah present for the boy, and she says, I'm thinking of getting him something easy, like the Ramban. It stuck in my head, because to this day I'm convinced that she had never opened a Ramban in her life. If she did, she probably would not have said that. But in any event, so we begin, and he really beckons us to take a good, proper look at the psukim here. Of course, the question, the overarching question with the Miraglim is that it ended in a disaster. It ended in a tragedy. But did it have to end in tragedy? In other words, was it ill-fated? Was it ill-conceived? So the first thing, as Ramban mentions, that we need to take into account is that the beginning of Parsha Shelach is not the beginning of the episode of the Miraglim. Because if you look in the opening of Shelach, where Hashem says to Moshe, Shlach lecha anashim, you get the idea that it was Hashem's idea, so to speak. But we discover from the Torah later on that actually that's not so. Rather, Bnei Yisrael were the ones who originally approached Moshe with the idea. That's mentioned, interestingly, for reasons that we will yet need to discuss, not in Parshat Shelach, in real time, so to speak, but rather in retrospect, in Parshas Devarim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Beis, Moshe said, "Vatikruvun elai kulchem, you all approached me. Vatomer, you said, Nishlecha nashim lefaneinu, let's send people. V'yachbur lana sa'aretz, let them search out the land, spy the land. V'yashivu asanu davar, and bring us back information. Et ha'derech ha'shena leba, which way should we approach? Et ha'arim ha'shena v'olehen, which city should we enter first?" So the idea, historically, in its inception, came from Bnei Yisrael. And moreover, if we ask the question, namely, was it a good idea? Was it a bad idea? Was it either? Did it have to be either? Says Ramban, in principle, it is a perfectly acceptable idea to send a group of people to take a look and see how the whole thing will begin. That is 100% acceptable. It's what's known in the parlance as hishtadlus. I mean, that's completely legitimate, because otherwise you're relying on a miracle, and that's something that we're not necessarily meant to do. And indeed, we find that in later episodes, Miraglim were sent. And moreover, Miraglim were sent by those who were involved in the parsha of the original Miraglim. So they'd been burnt by an episode of Miraglim, but it didn't stop them from sending their own Miraglim, because somehow our parsha represents the wrong way to do it, and they did it the right way, and they were not discouraged. The Haftorah for Parsha Shelach is Yoshua Perek Beis, which is Yoshua sending Miraglim. Yoshua was one of the original Miraglim. On a superficial level, we would say he of all people should have avoided this like the plague. But he did not. He sent two men, and one of those men was his fellow Miragel, Kalev ben Yefune. The other was Pinchas. And it worked out fine. And moreover, Moshe himself, and we don't even need to move as far forward as Yoshua, which is not that far. Moshe himself, later on in Bamidbar, the Pasuk says, sent Miraglim in Parshas Chukas. That was the already the beginning of trying to ascertain which is the best point of entry. So Yeshua sent Meraglim after this, Moshe sent Meraglim after this. Meraglim per se, Meraglim qua Meraglim, is okay. In which case, we will then need to find out what went wrong. Now, how does Hashem, so to speak, once we've seen the initiative come from the Jewish people, how does Hashem respond to this? Well, that brings us to the beginning of Parshas Shelach. We look at the words, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Le'emor, Perek Yud Gimel, the opening. Psukim, Shlech Lecha Anashim, send men. And Ramban says, that's a yes. That's endorsing. That's legitimizing. We should note, and it's interesting to see how Lashon HaKodesh questions really contain within them, in a sense, broader issues. The pasuk says, Shlach Lecha. There's an emphasis on the word Lecha. And Ramban doesn't respond to it, as if to say he doesn't look at the word Shlach Lecha any differently than if you look at the word Shlach. That extra word Lecha doesn't have another meaning, or it doesn't have any type of qualification. And the reason why is because this is something Ramban has stated very early on in his Perush on the Chumash. The extra word Lecha, in his words, is Derech HaKosuv. That's the way the Torah talks. Lech Lecha, Shlach Lecha, Brach Lecha, Eilechli, Holachlo. I mean, it's nothing unusual about it, and therefore there's no special response that one needs. And he says this, actually, in reaction to Rashi there in Lech Lecha. As we know, Rashi has a great deal to say about the word Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha, Hashem says to Avram, back in Bereishis, Lech Lecha. And Rashi says, it's Lahana Asacha and Latovascha, it's for your benefit, for your good, right? Rashi looks at the word Lecha, it's for you. And Ramban says, don't make anything of the word Lecha, al derech hapshat. But Rashi does. And that machlokus follows us into Shlach Lecha. Because whereas Ramban sees no need for a special comment on the word Lecha, Rashi does. And for Rashi, this opens a whole new dimension. Because it already sets HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, apart from the Jewish people, even from Moshe. Because Shlach Lecha, as Rashi says, and it's actually quoting the Gemara in Masechet Sota, L'da'atecha, it's up to you. I'm not going to stop you. I'm not telling you to do it. Eini mitzavischa. I'm not going to command you to do it. In tirtzeh, shlach. If you want, you can. And the Rashi then provides further background. Because the Jewish people came, they wanted to send spies. Moshe asked Hashem, and what does Hashem say? Ani amarti, this is a very, an amazing Rashi. Ani amarti lahem shehi tova. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, why do they want to send spies? I told them it's a good land. Shenemar, Eleske, Me'oni Mitzrayim, El Eretz Tova, I told you it's a good land. And you still want to send spies? That's not good. That's already a wrongdoing, and therefore it's almost like they say, if that's the way they've chosen, so be it. They could lose by it, because sending Meraglim could lead them down a very downward spiral. And all of this, as we said, is Rashi responding to the word Lecha. It's Lecha, and not necessarily good from Hashem's point of view. And that's Rashi, which itself, I mean, philosophically also needs a great deal of pondering, this idea that Hashem is saying it's not a good idea, but he doesn't stop them, and even gives an opening for things to work out badly. I mean, but again, Rashi's job is not to teach us philosophy. Rashi's job is to be Miashir Pshuto Shemikra. Once he's done that, his job is finished. Our work then begins to try and understand the implications of what it is that Rashi said. But in any case, back to Ramban, as we said, Shlach Lecha is the same as Shlach. Hashem is on board, so to speak, and it's all good. And indeed, Moshe then, there's many psukim here. There's a good 20 psukim before anyone's left. Moshe sends them, and he gives them instructions as to what to look out for. And Pasuk Yud Ches, and specifically we want to see Pasuk Yud Ches as compared with Pasuk Yud Tes. Different things to look for, seemingly. What is Pasuk Yud Ches? Or Isim Esaret Mahi? What is the land? Meaning Esa'ame Yoshevalea, Hechazoku Harache, Hamatu Imrav, see other people, are they strong? This is yet tactics, as if to say, where are they strongest, where are they weakest? That's in keeping with normal rigul, so to speak. Then Moshe seems, if we pay close attention, to add another element to what they're looking to find out. Pasuk Yotes, Umah Haaretz, Ashehu Yoshev Ba. What about the land? Hatova hi imra'a. Is it good or is it bad? Now, seemingly, that is a different type of question. That's not so much a question of strategy, it's a question of evaluation of quality, interestingly. And what are we to make of that? Especially as, isn't it true that the kosher type of rigul is purely a question of strategy? So why do we have this other element here? So Ramban says it could be on a simple level that this also is about strategy. Is it good or bad? Meaning, where are the good or bad places to attack from first or to try and possible? But it is also possible, says Ramban, that here indeed Moshe is capitalizing, so to speak, on the fact that they're going anyway for kosher purposes, namely to work out their tactics and a method of approach. Once they're there, says Moshe, you're going to see the land. No, come back and tell us whether it's a good land. Obviously, the answer is it's a good land, which is the actual truth. What they came back and said was something else. But in other words, Moshe is, in today's parlance, they would say, tofes tramp on the fact that they're going anyway to ask them to bring back information about this other element, the quality of the land. If they were only going to see the quality of the land, he wouldn't have let them go. That's possible. But they're going for kosher purposes as a sniff, as a branch of their delegation or investigations to bring back that information as well. So these are the opening comments of Ramban, what we could call his first approach, where it's all moving forward and everyone seems to be on the same page. But then, says Ramban, there is another possibility. You see, what's very interesting is there is a missing link, shall we say. There's something which is not explicitly stated. Namely, we know that Bnei Yisrael put the idea to Moshe. We know that Hashem endorsed the idea or said to move ahead. What's missing is the piece in between. Namely, a pasuk saying that Moshe relayed the people's request to Hashem, which would then lead to that response. Well, it is possible that Moshe did relay it and the pasuk doesn't say it. That happens quite often. However, says Ramban, it's also possible that Moshe actually, it's interesting to think about it in this way, Moshe did not ask Hashem. And the reason why he didn't ask is because, once again, if we're in the realms of kosher hishtadlus, so then that's something that a person is entitled to do without necessarily asking. As surely as, again, to refer to the later people that Moshe sent, the later Meraglim, it seems it was his own initiative. He didn't ask of Hashem to do that. That's perfectly acceptable, which means that the whole thing is actually going ahead without consulting with Hashem because Moshe feels it's not necessary. And from his point of view, it wasn't, which is very interesting. Because if that's true, then when Hashem enters and starts to talk about it, he's kind of intervening. In other words, no one's really asked him, because they didn't feel it's necessary, but he talks about it anyway. And the reason why is because he feels it's necessary to talk about it. In other words, the question now will be, why is he telling them to go ahead with something that they were going ahead with anyway without asking? What's in that input? Says Ramban, what's interesting is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling them is that he is modifying the delegation. As if to say, if Hashem hadn't said anything, the way they would have sent Meraglim, they would have sent, but it would have been different than the way they ended up sending. Specifically, there's one or two examples, but specifically, if we ask the question, how many people should go? How many spies should go? Well, we know from other occasions, I mean, you don't send all 12. That's not very spy-like. That's not good spycraft. You send 12. They start davening mincha, and the whole cover is blown. So in other words, you see with Yehoshua, he sends two men, two good men. Cheresh, hash hash, that's all you need. They don't want to be a whole group. They don't take up a whole bus. And there is room to assume, says Ramban, that that's what Moshe would have done. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu stopped him, and he modified and said, no, I know you're sending spies. Here's how to do it. Ish echad, ish echad lashavet. Each tribe has to be represented. And the question is, why? What's behind this addition, this modification? Says Ramban, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, obviously here it's a delicate area because we're talking about foreknowledge and people's free will, etc. There is no question that even in terms of leaving room for free will, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is aware, so to speak, that things could go badly wrong. And therefore, he insists that every tribe be represented there for two reasons, says Ramban. Number one, it will give the delegation more of a chance of doing the right thing. When it's just a couple of people, you know, they can have a conversation and before they're finished, you know, it's already all sorted out. When each person represents a different Shevet, then there's room to hope that it's really the common good that will unite them. So that's number one, in order to increase the chances of a good outcome. But that does not preclude the possibility that there will be a bad outcome. And if there is, says Ramban, that's another reason why every tribe needs to be represented, because they're all in it together. Hopefully it will work out well, but if it doesn't, you can't have 10 of the Shvatim saying, well, you know, if we would have sent our man, that never would have happened. And there is another fascinating point, as a parshanut point. And that is, not only does Hashem contribute, so to speak, or help, in a sense, the situation by adding information, he helps by even commanding Moshe to send. And the reason why is because there's a world of difference between something that one does without asking Hashem, or without Hashem saying something, and something he does as a result of Hashem's command. As soon as Hashem commands, that, by definition, a commandment from Hashem, is a mitzvah. And therefore, when one moves ahead, then, it is in performance of a mitzvah. We have a principle, and it's a factor in an equation, but it is a factor. Shluchei mitzvah, eino nizokim. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, almost like he takes a grassroots idea and turns it into a mitzvah in order to give them that added elevation in terms of making good and doing the right thing when they visit the land. And on the contrary, it's an amazing situation, because the Torah, so to speak, deletes their original request from real time. It doesn't go away. I mean, historically, as a fact, it doesn't go away, and we'll hear about it later on. But it shouldn't feature here, because if that would feature at the beginning, that would represent the conceptual launch and the qualitative launch of the Meraglim. By taking it away, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a sense, is almost like replacing their idea with his idea in order to elevate it, in order to kasher it. So that the question is, whose idea was it? Historically, it was theirs. But actually, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's idea. And that should help them. And they need all the help they can get, as we know. The final point here is that the verbs are very interesting. Again, Ramban, from the big discussions to the smallest details, or most particular details, there are no small details. The verb that the Jewish people used when they suggested this was, they said, Nishlacha anashim lefaneinu, v'yachberu lanu es ha'aretz. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in the beginning of the parsha, Shlach lecha anashim v'yosuru es eretz kanan. What is the difference between them? Well, says Ramban, at this level, the yachberu is all about trying to find the weak points for strategic purposes, literally to dig up, find the right point of entry. And that's what they were asking for. It was HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in this approach of Ramban, that added the element of, if you're going already for those reasons, go also to evaluate the quality of the land, the Yosur Eseretz Canaan, which means that B'nai Yisrael had one reason for going, strategic, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu added another reason to evaluate the land itself, the quality of living there. And there, and in this regard, when Moshe says, see if the land is, or the people are strong or weak, that's in terms of the Yachberu, that's in terms of their delegation for strategic purposes. When he then says, is the land good or not, that's in fulfillment of the Yosuru. So you really have what they would call in Brisk, two dinim, happening within the delegation here. They're going for two reasons, and therefore there's two sets of questions they need to answer. But in the final analysis, says Ramban, it did turn out badly, which means that there was something wrong from the outset. And if we may ask, what was so wrong if the Ishtadlis is correct? Well, says Ramban, as is often the case with Ishtadlis, a person's endeavor and a person's investment and their initiative, a great deal of the quality is about the way you go about it. Because Ishtadlis can be kosher, but it can also be unkosher. Wherein can we tell the difference? Says Ramban, the telling words are Vatikravun Eli Kulchem. You all came to me with this question. And the question is, why? It's interesting to ponder. What is motivating the Jewish people to ask this? As if to say, the leadership of the Jewish people is generally left up to the leadership, not to the Jewish people. We never find that they approach the leadership with other ideas that they have for how the Jewish people should best move forward or do things. Generally, they leave that up to Moshe Rabbeinu, which is a good idea, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is a very good idea. And therefore, it's them an interesting question. What's pushing them to suggest sending spies? Do they think that if they don't suggest it, no one else will think of it? And why would they think that? And moreover, why does everyone need to come and present this idea? As soon as there's a crowd all coming, I mean, it's a good shiloh to ponder philosophically. How many Jewish people does it take to suggest one thing? The answer should be one. Or two, or one per tribe or something. Not the entire Jewish people. I mean, that's a lot of people. And therefore, says Ramban, there was something. The idea is okay, but the way it's presented can be decisive. And if everyone comes, and they're pretty sure that if they don't suggest this, no one else will think of that. And by no one else, that means not Moshe, and not HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though if they're right, these are good ideas for the Jewish people. That's quite suspect. And therefore, when as much as for reasons that we explained, the suggestion of the Jewish people is not mentioned in Shelach, but it is mentioned in Devarim. It's not just to fill in historical information. Devarim, as we know, the nature and the fabric of Devarim, the beginning Parsha certainly, is Tochacha, it's rebuke of Moshe on the part of the Bnei Yisrael. And really, therefore, it does take its place as part of the rebuke, because looking back, there was something that was amiss here, which needs to be spoken about and learned from. So these are some of the comments of Ramban, and as we said, very solid, both in terms of the ideas themselves and the readings of the psukim, certainly very important comments. Well, the Meraglim do not rise to the occasion. And they come back with bad reports, almost all of them. The Jewish people similarly believe it and begin to complain, etc. And it gets to such a chronic degree that in the end, as we know, the tragic result is they all die out in the wilderness. And if we take a look in Perek Yudalit, Pasuk Kaftes, he gets many, many psukim here dealing with the Meraglim. Or perhaps to cue ourselves in Pasuk Kafvav, Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe Vel Aaron Lemor, of Perek Yutalet. Ad Mosai Le'eda Hara Hazos, for how long will this bad congregation, Hashehema Malilim Alai, they're causing murmuring and complaints and dissent. Estelunos Bnei Yisrael, Hashehema Malilim Alai Shamati. I've heard the complaints, it's enough. Emor Alehem, Chai Oni Noom Hashem, say to them, as I live, says Hashem, everything you said will be done to you. It's a terrible moment, because they said we're going to die here, and in a sense they pronounced their punishment. What you said, that's what will be. Pasuk Kaftes, and this is the pasuk that we want to focus on. Bamidbar hazeh yiplu pigrechem, in this wilderness indeed you'll all fall. V'chol pikudechem l'chol mispachem, all of those are counted. Miben esrim shana v'mala, from 20 years onwards. Asher halinosem alai, that you caused complaints and dissent against me. And the gist of the pasuk is clear, that they'll die in the midbar, we know, each year, from the age, the culpable age was 20, But the words that really catch the attention of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh are the final words, Nosem Alai, that you complained against me. And the question, says Orach Chaim, is what are these words adding? I mean, what is the pasuk missing without them, and what are they supplementing? I mean, we know that they complained. In fact, not only do we know that they complained, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has said, I've heard them complaining. So that's all established. It's all been stated. One doesn't need at this point, when you're talking about those 20 years, everyone complained, by the way, to add these words, Asher Halinosim, that you complained against me, that's known. Perhaps we will say that this is the reason why they'll all die in the Midbar, because, but Asher doesn't mean because, Asher means that, because it's Al Asher Halinosim Alai. So these words really, they conclude the Pasuk, and we're not quite sure what to do with them. And the Orach Chaim HaKadosh has a most fascinating interpretation of these words. What's the punishment? They'll die in the Midbar. Why? What's the crime? As far as we're concerned, the answer is quite straightforward. Because of everything that happened just now, on this evening, at Tisha B'Av and the Meraglim, and they believed them, and they were complaining. And so that's it. That's the punishment, and that's the crime. However, it's not so straightforward. As radical as the idea sounds, it is possible that this punishment is not only for the sin of the Meraglim. Now, why would we say that? I mean, isn't it quite clear, black on white? Meraglim equals this punishment? Not at all. Because there's something else, black on white, which is mentioned earlier on. And that is in Pasuk Kaf Beis. Kaf Beis states, all of those men who saw my glory, my signs that I did in Mitzrayim and the Midbar, they've tried me for 10 times, tested me 10 times, and did not follow, did not heed my words. If they will see the land, meaning they won't see the land. So this is very interesting. Because this is really the only time where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is really addressing a wrongdoing, but as really the culmination of a whole list of wrongdoings. I mean, this is the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Esen Es Yonos, Nisav Esen Es HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bamidbar, as it says, Vayinasu Osi, Zeh Eser Pa'amim. But why is Hashem says that they tested me 10 times? The implication seems to be that it's because it's 10 times already. It's enough already. What if it was the first time? What if they'd been perfect until this point, and this was the first time? It's possible, just a simple inference, that perhaps they would not have been punished with such a severity. But it's not the first time. It's the 10th time. Okay, well, so be it. What difference does it make? The age of culpability is 20. Says Orach Chaim HaKadosh, the Avera of the Meraglim, this Parsha, happened in the second year of the Midbar, as we know. So now the question is, well, who is liable to be punished? Someone who's at the age of 20. But the question is, someone who's age of the 20, when? And here it makes a world of difference as to whether the punishment is only for this Avera, or for the first 9 as well, and it's cumulative. It's accrual. If it's only for the Chet HaMeraglim, then if you're 20, they're the Chet HaMeraglim, so you're 20, and you're part of the punishment. But if this is number 10 in a list of 10, and the first 9 are also part of it, and they're contributing factors, but what if you weren't 20 then? What about all those people that actually became 20 in the second year, but in the first year, where 9 of the 10 wrongdoings happened, they were 19? Below, younger than the age of liability for punishment. If it's cumulative, then they would not have been punished. And says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, that is the meaning of these finest. Mibenesim shana v'mala. Anyone who's 20, asher halinosem alai. In contrast with the earlier pasuk, which is asher malinim alai, currently. But when we talk about the age of 20, it's the age of 20, Asher Halinosem Alai. They've got to be 20 from the time that they were from the beginning complaining and dissenting. And therefore, according to this, anyone who only became 20 this year, they became 20. I mean, their mazel is that they're 20 for number 10, but 19 for numbers 1 to 9. And they would not be punished. And, says the Arachaim HaKadosh, it could be that this is what's behind a rather well-known episode that took place in year 40. Which is one of the origins or contributing factors to the special nature of a day called Tu B'Av. Tu B'Av is just in a league of its own. And there's many, many reasons why. The Gemara says, Mishnah says, it's one of the two happiest days in the year. The other is Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, Tu B'Av. And the Gemara wants to know, what's up with Tu B'Av and what happened on Tu B'Av already? And one of the answers, the one that we'll be discussing now, as I'm sure you know, is that the Jewish people every night on Tisha B'Av, I mean, that was the night that a lot of them went to sleep. It didn't get up again in the morning because they were the ones for that year who the year had come. And in the final year, so you had these, I think, however many it turned out to be, 15,000, that they thought it was their turn. So they went to sleep. I don't know if they went to sleep, but they were prepared, but they were still around in the morning. So then they got to thinking, maybe we got the day wrong. So it was a very fraught few days, but by the time they got to the 15th of Av, and it's a full moon, there's no way they made a mistake. There's no way it's Tisha B'Av anymore, it's a full moon. And they realized that they've been given a reprieve. But the question is, what's behind that reprieve? I mean, we're not complaining, but what's the background to the fact that every year, that year's amount of people, they died in fulfillment of this punishment, and then this final year didn't die? So the Rachaim HaKadosh says, because this year was all of those people that were not actually 20 from the beginning. This was the year of those who turned from 19 to 20 in the second year, and therefore, the punishment did not apply to them, but they didn't realize that. And therefore, that's what's behind the fact that if they were 20, but only from year 2, they weren't 20 for all 10 offenses. Asher halinosem alai, they're not involved. But the Rachaim HaKadosh goes further, and this is, again, a fascinating parshanut point. Because until this point, it really sounds like Tu B'Av was based on a misunderstanding. In other words, they just didn't learn the Pasuk right. If they had the commentary of the Rachaim HaKadosh, everything would have been fine. They would have known from the beginning that Asher halinosem and they're not involved, but they thought they were involved. So Tu B'Av isn't so much they've been granted a reprieve. It dawned on them that they were never really part of the sentence in the first place. But says the Rachaim, it's possible that something else is happening. In other words, a phrase like this, Asher halinosem alai, it's so subtle. It's so delicate. It could really go either way. If you really put it through the mill, you could conclude that it means you have to have been 20 from the first time. But it could mean something else. What's the point? The point is, very often, says the Rachaim HaKadosh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, presents a sentence or something that will be, but it's not presented in absolute terms because there yet remains room for leeway, because so much could happen between now and then. Sometimes things are deliberately presented in an ambiguous way in order to yet allow the final outcome to be determined by what happens between now and then. He gives a fascinating example. He says to Adam, not to eat from the Eitz Hadas, ki v'yom achol chamimeno mos tamos. That's quite clear. The words are seemingly, there's no two ways about it. But there are two ways about it. Because when it says biyom, in a day, so whose day? And there's quite a discrepancy between the different days. Our day is 24 hours. Hashem's day, ki el Hashem beinecha, ki yom esmol, shmur balayla, Hashem's day is 1,000 years. So even when you say that you'll die on that day, there are still two possibilities. But why are there two possibilities? Because the question is, but what will Adam do then? Will he do tshuva? Will he not do tshuva? The locking down of the specific meaning of those words is yet to be determined by what happens next. You have the general framework, but there's still different possibilities. People can choose to react in different ways. Had Adam not done tshuva, he would have died on that day there and then. And that would have been the rendition of B'yom Achal Chamimena. Because he did tshuva, the word yom took on a different meaning. It's all within the realms of those possible meanings, but there's more than one because there's more than one possible outcome. So too says the Rahaim HaKadosh. These words are phrased in this way, Asher Halinosim Alai, because that final group, they were still in the balance. And depending on how they acted and behaved from this point onward, it could either have meant to exclude them or to include them, which means it really was a reprieve. They suspected the worst, but the truth is they merited to have a good interpretation of these words. That's really a fascinating idea from the Rahaim HaKadosh there, and as he mentions it, it's something that we find elsewhere as well. I'd like to conclude the final section, although we'll take a good few moments, by talking about one of the very interesting aspects of the parsha, and that it's contained within the mitzvah of tzitzis, and the reference is to the aspect of techeles. At techeles, well, I would certainly say it's a very colorful topic, and there's a great deal to say. And we'll take a look at a few highlights. It's certainly something that's very much, if you go into a store and you can see someone selling trailers, so then to know a little bit of the background as to what it's all about. So, firstly, I mean, what is trailers? It's some type of blue thread. There's a shaila. How many of the eight are to be blue? Is it one? Is it two? Is it four out of the eight? But in any case, the trailers was with us. It comes from something called the chilozon, and we had it pretty much uninterruptedly, certainly until the end of the sealing of the Gemara, Chasimas HaTalmud, which took place, it was in about the year 550 of the Common Era. From that point onwards, everyone has treles, it's available. Even the early Gaonim had the treles. Rav Achai, who was one of the earliest, the Sheiltas of Rav Achai Gaon, he was in possession of Treles. The next thing we hear, there's a bit of a silence then, the next official thing we hear about the Treles is from the Medrash Tanchuma, which bemoans the fact that there is no Treles anymore. Now the Medrash Tanchuma was redacted in the year 730 of the Common Era. So in those intermitting 180 years, somehow the Treles was discontinued. And indeed, it is known that there were terrible, terrible upheavals during that time. I mean, that part of history for us, it's not so much in our consciousness, but in the 600s, in the 620, year 628, there were massacres there perpetrated by Christians. In 639, it was conquered by Arabs. I mean, between one thing and another, and each one decimated the yishuv there, and a lot of things that had continued uninterrupted were suspended until further notice. And thus, by the time the Medrash Tanchuma comes, a few decades nationwide events, Treles is not available anymore, and they don't have it. And that's pretty much where things lay. Until over 1,000 years later, in the late 1900s, actually, in the year 1887, one of the Hasidish Rebbes, the Radziner Rebbe, or Gershon Henoch Lehner of Radzin, he took it upon himself to discover what the Treles was. And the place that he went to, where he felt that he had the most chance of finding out, was to Italy. And there were aquariums there and all sorts of different things. And he conducted his investigations. And he came up with what he felt was the solution. Now, we should state already at the outset, in terms of the information that we have and the opinions that we have, it is by definition impossible to come up with a color of treles that will satisfy all halachic opinions. It cannot be. And the reason why is because the treles comes from the blood of this chilozon. What color is that blood? Already there, we have a machlokus. Rashi says that blood is blue. Ramban says that it's black. So that's number one. You already have to choose. And that's in terms of the blood of the chilozon. But then the dye that comes out, what color is that? Well, the answer that we're familiar with, what we call trelet, which doesn't help because modern Hebrew, in a sense, has paskened on the definition of trelet. Trelet in modern Hebrew is sky blue. And the Rambam says trelet is sky blue. that Rashi says it's a darker blue. It's not the blue of the sky. It's the blue of the sea. And the Ibn Ezra says that it could be that Tchelis is black, or maybe it's green. Well then, that's just a bit of the background to understand that there's different opinions here. I think it's fair to say that not everything in life is blue and white. And so, however, the Rav Diner, he made his decisions, and he came up with a fish. It's called a cuttlefish. And the blood was black. However, once it was treated with certain chemicals, it came out to be that kind of sky blue. And that's it. He found it. And so he brought it back with him. And he spread it amongst his Hasidim. And he wrote actually three volumes about this. Ein HaTcheles and Sfunei Tmunechol. And however, not everyone accepted his Tcheles. The Hasidim, of course, did. His Hasidim for sure. Others, not so much. And a lot of the counter discussion here begins in the early 1900s, which took place through the other investigations of Rav Herzog, Zatzal. Rav Herzog spent a lot of time looking into the Tcheles. In fact, as far as I know, his doctoral thesis was on the Tcheles. The first thing he did was he wrote to the Radziner Hasidim. And he said to them, please, will you supply for me the process and the way in which Tcheles is procured according to your opinion? And they did. And so he took it and he started to work with it. And he went back to them and says, as far as I'm concerned, it's quite clear to me that this is not the Tcheles. I just thought you should be informed. You might be interested to know. As it turned out, they weren't interested to know. But that will come out a little bit later. But the reason why is because, says Rav Herzog, the blood itself of this fish is black. But when you add certain chemicals, it turns blue. However, says Rav Herzog, I took many, many other types of things which are also not blue. I added the same chemicals to them and they came out blue. Which means that it's much more a result of the chemicals. You could add them to many different types of things, and it will come out blue. It doesn't seem that this is the... And the truth is that at that point, Rav Herzog began to open, in a sense, new directions. Not only what color trailers might be, what the chilozon might be. Quite radical ideas. And his first, in a sense, breakthrough departure from the Radziner is that he felt that the chilozon is not even actually a fish, but it's a kind of a snail. And the reason why he says that is because there are a couple of places in the Talmud which seem to indicate that the chilozon is a snail. There is an interesting halachic discussion in Hilchos Shabbos, which talks about someone who traps a chilozon. How many malachas would he violate? Trapping towards a malacha. And then says the Gemara, Hatzad chilozon v'hapotzeo. Now what does potzea mean? Potzea means to crack or to snap, which isn't really relevant for a fish. I mean, a fish, no one cracks a fish. Rather, says Rav Herzog, it seems that the chilozon is something that can be cracked. In other words, because of the shell, it's a snail. Secondly, says Rav Herzog, the Gemara in Maseches Megillah on Daf Vav refers to the, or quotes the pasuk in Vezos HaBracha, Sfunei Tumunei Chol, that which is hidden in the sand, and says that it refers to the chilozon. A fish can't be hidden in the sand. A snail, amphibious, it can be in the sea, can be in the sand, and therefore it sounds like there's a good chance that it's actually a snail and not a fish. That's number one. But number two, says Rav Herzog, is that it's also possible that it isn't really the blood of the snail that gives you the tchelis, but another liquid that's kind of secreted there. The Gemara calls it the blood, but it's not the blood itself in that same way, and that's really what he worked with. Now, what's interesting is, in the interest of MS, Rav Herzog himself did not reach a conclusion. He presented this as what he felt was the most viable candidate for tchelis. It's a snail, it's called the Murex trunculus. But he expressed reservations. But interestingly, others took that idea and followed through with it lemaisa, as if to say, the chaylef that is produced now, this is from that snail. Now, what's interesting just historically, and it's kind of sad, but also is that the house of Radzin, I mean, was destroyed during the Holocaust. And there were only a few Hasidim who made it out, and with the destruction of the house of Radzin, they lost the way to do the treilas. There was only one person who knew how Radzin has made the treilas, and that's Rav Herzog, because he had all that information. He was already here in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the Hasidim wrote him and said, you know, our fathers or whatever, they sent you all those years ago the way to make the treilas. We don't have it anymore. Could you send it back? And the Rav Herzog says, yes, of course, with pleasure. I've told you that I don't think that's a treilas at all. And they said, well, the Rebbe said it's treilas. So we, with all due respect to your opinion, just give us the recipe and we'll take it from there. And thus it was Rav Herzog, it was the one who provided them with their treilas back again. Now, just a couple of really, you know, technical things, because even this snail, when this secretion comes out, it's actually purple. But and that's why Rav Herzog had reservations about it, because he didn't feel that purple would satisfy Chelis really according to any opinion. However, they point out that if you leave it long enough in the sun, it gets much blue. That's why it's come to be accepted by those that accept it. Well, the question is, achar hadvarim ha'ele, where does that leave everyone? Does everyone need now to go out and buy treiles? On the one hand, all must yet concur that this is not conclusive, as if to say it's quite persuasive, and there's a very good chance, but as if to say this is absolutely it, I don't think anyone says that it's absolutely it. On the other hand, there's room to say that one can't lose by putting the treiles. Because the worst case scenario, if it's not the treiles, is that one of your tzitzis is blue. And that's okay. I mean, it's not treiles, but it's a blue string. Blue string is actually kosher for tzitzis. However, there is a counterpoint here. It's a little bit more elusive, but nonetheless important to mention. The Beis Halevi is famous for saying that treiles is one of those things that you need a masorah for. In other words, as surely as we have in the halachas of kashrus, it's not enough to be able to reclaim from scientific investigation or experimentation, etc. It's the sort of thing that you need the treiles, you need a masorah for. And without a masorah, so you don't have it until further notice. Interestingly, coming back to our parsha, the parsha of tzitzis, which is well known to us, as I think his grandson, the Brisker Rebbe, Velvel Soloveitchik, points out, when it comes to tzitzis, v'nasulem tzitzis, akan pevig dehem ledorosam, v'nasnu al tzitzis akanav, pesil techeles. So when it comes to the essential mitzvah of tzitzis, it says ledorosam, for all generations. And when it comes to techeles, it doesn't say ledorosam. And that is cited in support for this idea that, in other words, it could be discontinued and you may need to wait for future times. And indeed, the Zohar Kodesh says that the treiles is something that needs to happen until Mashiach, is put in abeyance until Mashiach comes. So these are some of the classic discussion points, at least, for the treiles. But what's very interesting is, and with this we'll finish up,